All matters of persons having anything to bring before the Honorable Justice of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now go near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the honorable court.
Good morning. The court's ready to hear argument in Beckett versus BB Medical. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Go on.
May it please the court, this is an appeal from the Superior Court for a dismissal of a complaint alleging malpractice when a toothpick was left in the plaintiff's foot after surgery by the doctor to remove it. The issue is the construction of the statute that was enacted in July of 2003 and then amended in October of 2003, which requires an affidavit of the of merit in a malpractice case. The statute initially said that if the affidavit of merit was not filed, then the complaint would be shall be dismissed. However, in October 2003, the statute was amended to expressly strike the requirement that it shall, be dismissed, and substituted in lieu thereof the requirement that the proprietary not accept the complaint without the affidavit of merit. The intent, of course, I think was clear that they simply, the legislature decided, and it was sort of like a compromise, I'm sure, by the medical profession and legal profession and other parties. They simply did not want suits filed so that the doctor would even have to hire an attorney and so forth and so on. So this was a way of preventing that. However, it was clear in the statute that when they did that, they put in various escape routes, various safety nets to protect a worthy plaintiff from being, well, from being deprived of his or her day in court by this statute if for some reason the affidavit of merit could not be obtained in time or for some reason the person or the attorney did not file it or whatever reason. And the statute provided for a 90-day extension of the statute of limitation by certified mail, and then also provided for a 60-day extension by filing a motion, which in reality gives you more than 60 days because the motion, the 60 days will not start until after the motion is heard and decided. So with those protective safety nets, the legislature took out the requirement that the complaint be dismissed. I mean, they literally struck that. They literally took that section out and said...
Well, they said the complaint will not be filed.
Right.
They said, is there any functional difference between the provision that was taken out saying that the complaint shall be dismissed and one saying that the complaint shall not be filed in the first instance?
I think there is that difference, Justice. The difference is that now they have made the proprietary the gatekeeper. So the proprietary now has an obligation not to accept the complaint. But if it accepts a complaint without this affidavit...
Even mistakenly?
Even mistakenly, because...
What is the support for that construction?
Well, this is a brand new statute, and there really is no support of any kind. I mean, when one looks...
I think you're asking us to, as a matter of first impression, to construe the statute that way.
Yes. I'm asking the court to... Well, as far as Beckett is concerned, there are really three lines of defense, so to speak, or maybe even more than three. The first issue is, does the exception of a foreign object unintentionally left after surgery apply to an object such as a toothpick that was not placed there by the doctor, but the doctor was retained, hired, his purpose, goal was to remove it. He knew it was there, and he had to remove it. Now, there is only one case in Delaware that discusses this, and that is this Lacey case that's 21 years old by Judge Taylor, which really the gist of that case was that the doctor did not take the IUD out intentionally, but in dicta, if you wish, or as part of the opinion, the judge, Judge Taylor said, but also this doesn't apply. That, of course, dealt with an inference, but a prior statute or a different goal, a different statute that talked about an inference that will allow you to really get to the jury, like a res ipsa loquitur type of argument. Of course, the statute was then amended in July of 03 to basically say, no, it's dismissed, or shall be dismissed if there's an affidavit, except for this three exceptions. This was one of them. So the first argument is
that's the first issue.
First issue, yes.
What are the other two issues?
Okay, second issue is the issue that the statute intentionally uses allege. So that, the word allege. So it says that if it is alleged, quote alleged, that there is an exception, one of these three exceptions, then the affidavit merit is required. Now, the legislature could have used certify, prove, could have used any word they wanted to use. They chose to use allege. And I believe that this court, what they intended to do, and this court, how the court should construct this, this is they, because they're not using certify. I mean, the court rules use certify many times, like Rule 16.1, you have to certify that the value is excess of 100,000. So the word certify is something that is used in court rules.
How would that, let's assume you're right, the exception applies, at least in the first instance, if you, on behalf of a plaintiff, allege that one of the exceptions apply. And then a motion is made to dismiss for the precise reasons that it was made here, and the court determines that even though you may have alleged that an exception applies, in fact, the exception does not apply. What happens then?
Well, I think that once you get to the point where you've alleged it and the affidavit of merit is accepted, affidavit is not required, if the court determines that that was erroneous, that the allegation was wrong, unless the court finds it was done in bad faith, of course, to avoid the statute, but if it was done in good faith, I think the remedy would then be, okay, you're wrong, you alleged it, now you have to file an affidavit of merit or it gets dismissed. I mean, that would be the logical conclusion because
Judge Silverman did in the other case.
Exactly. Judge Silverman said there's no prejudice, so what the, you know, basically allow
that's supported by the rules of the Superior Court, and specifically, is there a conflict between sort of the strict approach of the statute and the perhaps more generous approach of the Superior Court rules that would allow for an amendment?
Well, I don't think there's any rules in the court other than Rule 60B, a deal of default judgment, I guess, which really doesn't apply technically, but the policy applies, the reasoning applies.
What about the rules for enlargement of time?
Rule 15C does talk about enlarging time, and that was raised in this appeal.
How about Rule 6B?
I'm not sure what 6B says, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Well, it says, when by these rules or by a notice given thereunder or by order of court an act is required or allowed to be done out of within a specified time, the court for cause shown may at any time in its discretion, one, with or without motion or notice, order the period enlarged if request therefore is made before the expiration of the period originally prescribed or as extended by a previous order, or two, upon motion made after the expiration of the specified period, permit the act to be done where the failure to act was the result of excusable neglect, but it may not extend the time for taking any action under Rules 50B, 52, 59B, D, and E, 60B, except to the extent and under the conditions stated in them.
I think that would be certainly applicable, but Judge Silverman, of course, in McBride, we were not citing any rules. He just simply said the plenary power of the court to allow this thing, the affidavit to be filed. But Rule 6B would clearly allow the enlargement of time, and assuming the court says, all right, you alleged it, you're wrong, but now under 6B we can enlarge the time to do it.
So the argument is, if you've alleged it in good faith, and you litigate that on the merits, and it turns out you were wrong on the merits,
then it should constitute excusable neglect under Rule 6, and you ought to then get to file the affidavit.
Yes, because I think that's completely in accordance with the intent of the statute and also with the court's rule and the court's policy of keeping the courthouse doors open and so forth, because no one has been prejudiced. I mean, the thing that is strange about this is that the affidavit merit is not even seen by the other side. It's a secret sealed envelope that the court can open if they choose to do so. But so how can they be prejudiced in any way?
Aren't they prejudiced to the extent that the defense is forced to go through a motion practice?
They're prejudiced to the extent, of course, that, I mean, they could have chosen not to dismiss it, or not to file the motion, of course. They could have simply said, there's no affidavit of merit, Your Honor, and we're going to file a motion unless they file an affidavit of merit. I mean, that would have been an easy, simple way, one phone call, one letter. But they chose, of course, to move to dismiss because obviously that was what they wanted to achieve. But the prejudice that I'm referring to is that it isn't like they are now delayed in any way, it isn't like they were misled in any way. Nothing has occurred to prejudice them in any way whatsoever.
What would happen in this case if you had not extended the courtesy of an extension to file the answer?
I would have taken a default judgment. And having taken a default judgment, they would, of course, then move to vacate the default judgment. The court would then have said, as the court did in Williams versus Del Colo, Judge Barron, was a case I was involved in, they said, all right, we're going to let you vacate the default judgment, but because this would prejudice the plaintiff, and now he's out of time to file this affidavit, then we will only do it with that condition that you will accept without the affidavit, or you can file the affidavit late. So if we had filed a default judgment, of course, we would be in a totally different situation because the court could then have said, no, we're not going to let you vacate it, or we'll let you vacate it, but not by prejudicing the plaintiff. Because if he had filed the answer on time on December 29th, and it's raised this motion, I would have had 4 or 5 days to run to court and file my motion for a 60-day extension. Interestingly, Mr. Epstein represented, and this is a prominent malpractice defense lawyer, who represented Phoebe, filed his answer on December 12th and never raised this as a defense. And reading that, frankly, honestly said, gee, no problem. And of course, the court allowed him to amend, so to speak, or adopt the defense of the co-defendant. But if they had been filed on time, then it would be a problem. And if the extension had not been granted, we'd have filed a motion for default judgment.
So, this is just an observation. I'm not suggesting any of your opponents did anything incorrect, and I know that Judge Cooch looked at it, but one of the sub-implications in this opinion is the custom and practice of courtesy among members of the Delaware Bar. As I understand the record in this case, the extension was granted after the time to answer the complaint was already due by you, and it was apparently done by your office routinely as a courtesy. Nobody got anything in writing. Nobody put down the extension was granted only if it's without prejudice to my client or anything like that. And then, as it turns out, the extension, when the answer was filed, there's this motion to dismiss, and there's nothing you can do, as you say.
Right.
So certainly one of the things the court has to think about are the implications for this professional courtesy and whether we're going to have to make everything formal so that people don't get caught in a situation like you did by trying to extend a professional courtesy.
I wish that you didn't have to do that. I've been an attorney for 40 years, maybe too long, but I mean, things have changed dramatically in what we're doing. I mean, sometimes I think I'm in New York, someplace, and I hope that doesn't happen. I mean, we used to do this verbally. We used to do, nothing was in writing. Now, it's just a horrible thing. I was frankly very distressed and depressed and still am by what happened here, because frankly, I don't think it would have happened 20 years ago.
Mr. Luna, excuse me, two questions. First, just factually, what was the date that you filed suit? And then when in relation to that did the statute of limitations expire?
I filed suit on November 22nd, 2004.
Okay.
And send a copy of the complaint, by the way, to the doctor to sign the motion, but not by certified mail.
When did the statute?
The statute would have expired on January 3rd or 4th, depending on how you view the day. It's not, never quite clear to me if you...
Everyone seems to be working with January 3rd.
January 3rd, if you want.
'05.
And the answer would have been due on December 29th for the doctor.
The extension was granted on December 30th, as I understand the correspondence.
No, I think the extension was granted either on the 3rd or the 4th. I mean, at least he called on the 3rd and the 4th.
Well, that's right. It was referred to the lawyer on the 30th.
Yeah.
Second question. What is the third and final issue?
Well, the third and final issue is that everything else fails. That is, if Your Honor finds exceptions apply, the allegations, so forth and so on, then I would ask you to follow Judge Silverman's, what I could consider to be a controlling precedent, and simply allow the affidavit to be filed at a time.
Any rebuttal time, do you want to say that? Or?
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Ferry, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
I understand you're going to open for 15 minutes and Mr. Altapan's going to reply.
That's correct, Your Honor.
For five, or continue for five.
That's correct. Before I get into the construction of the statute, Your Honors, I'd like to give a brief sort of history of how the Affidavit of Merit came about. And the Affidavit of Merit came about as a legislative compromise to tort reform. Back at that time, you may recall that this world, including our state, is somewhat contentious about malpractice and doctors fighting and insurance companies and consumers and the rest of it. This was the result of a compromise. I think the doctors and insurance carriers wanted caps and that type of thing, and so this is what resulted out of that particular round of...
Is there a synopsis in the record with the bill?
There was a short synopsis. It does not go into detail like that. It just gives a overview of what the statute is, but does not go into the legislative history as far as...
Is that in anybody's appendix? In this case?
It is. It's in our brief.
Okay.
It's definitely a footnote in our brief.
You know if the statute was patterned after in other states?
I don't think it was patterned after any particular state. I know Maryland requires an affidavit of merit, but if you look at Maryland statute, it's somewhat different. They have somewhat different rules. Other states require affidavit of merit, but they're all particular to that state and have slightly different language. So it's not copied or lifted from any particular state.
So my question about the synopsis, I saw it in your brief, that's the entire synopsis.
I believe it is.
All right. Now, there's a citation to a New Jersey case, in support of the position you and Mr. Elzevon are taking. Is the New Jersey statute like the Delaware statute?
It's similar, but it's not exactly the same way. I have not been able to find anything identical. Our statute is, I think, unique, and if you want to use that term.
Well, do you know if New Jersey has a statute comparable to Section 561 of Title 10 that says any inconsistency or conflict between any rule promulgated under the authority of this section or prior law and any provisions of this code or other statute of this state dealing with practice or procedure in the Superior Court shall be resolved in favor of such rule of court? Nothing in this code. Anything therein to the contrary, notwithstanding, shall in any way limit, supersede, or repeal any rule heretofore promulgated governing practice or procedure in civil actions in the Superior Court.
I don't know, Your Honor. Does
that statute have any application here? In other words, do you see a conflict between any Superior Court rule and the strict requirements of the statute?
Well, Your Honor pointed out in questioning Mr. Ramuno Rule 6A and B, and obviously, there are other statutes, such as the default judgment, where discretion is utilized. But my argument is that medical malpractice in Delaware is codified. It is not part of the general tort law. It is a creature of statute. It is based on statute. The entire thing was the result of tort reform compromise years ago, and that's why we have that at this point. I think that if there is any inconsistency between court rules and the statute would govern because it's more specific to medical malpractice.
Well, let me...
Even in spite of 561, which I just read to you, which says if there's a conflict between a statute and a court rule, the rule governs?
In 561 of?
Title 10.
Title 10.
That's the chapter on the procedure and powers of the Superior Court.
Well, I believe that the statute is specific to malpractice, and there are other areas in the code that indicate that this is supposed to be applied strictly, and that room for discretion is not there, and at least that's the intent of the legislature.
Well, let me follow up on that. I'm just thinking out loud, and since you're experienced in this area, you can react to the concerns I'm going to express. We have a statute of limitations, but then we have a separate affidavit requirement now. Let's suppose, hypothetically, that the suit had been filed 18 months after the event. So we have 6 months left on the statute of limitations. But there's no affidavit because it's alleged no affidavit is necessary. Then there's a motion to dismiss in this case that's briefed and argued. Everybody gets the routine time, and then the Superior Court gets 90 days to issue its decision. And when the decision is issued after the briefing and the argument, we're beyond the statute of limitations. It doesn't seem to be a very good system where you can file 6 months early, but then have your suit dismissed, even though you're alleged in good faith, no affidavit is required, simply because the briefing, the argument, and the decision took 6 months, whereas if it had been decided in 3 months, you could have cured it or something like that. So going back to Justice Ridgely's point, as a matter of the court, administering the court, if someone files a complaint that withstands the Rule 11 motion, good faith, allegations, why should they have to stand or fall on whether they were right 18 months, into the statute of limitations? Why doesn't it make sense to litigate that allegation on the merits and then, if they don't prevail, give them a short or reasonable amount of time to come up with the affidavit that the court determined they really did need?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's necessary. I think in the scenario that you suggest of 6 months or 3 months or whatever it may be, if it's been challenged, if there's been a motion filed, I think the plaintiff's attorney is going to go out and get the affidavit just to be on the safe side. I mean, that's the whole intent of this statute, is to eliminate frivolous suits, to make sure plaintiff's attorneys go to a physician ahead of time. This was the compromise that the doctors got out of the case.
Well, I think that's a good answer, and I'm only interrupting you because I don't want to use up all of your time with this line of thought. But that's what Mr. Romino did here, but he was near the end of the statute of limitations, and he granted this extension. As I understand it, an affidavit was filed in March, so it was a couple of months after the statute of limitations, but not that far from the 60 days he could have gotten if his motion had been timely.
I agree, Your Honor, and I will not stand here and tell you that we're prejudiced in any way, but neither is anyone prejudiced when the statute of limitations is missed. Rules are harsh sometimes, and I don't feel particularly great about having to argue this case. I've known Mr. Romino for years and years. It's not a particularly pleasant thing to do when there's the possibility that someone's case is going to be thrown out.
Well, however, I'm trying to make this distinction. You say statute of limitations are harsh, but the construction of the Superior Court in this case, in the one you're arguing in support of, as and I understand why, really moves the affidavit into the status of the statute of limitations, whereas they appear to be distinct under the statute, and as Mr. Romino says, there's even a provision in this statute for an extension of the statute of limitations by 90 days. It doesn't seem inconsistent with the normal operation of the Superior Court rules, especially Rule 6, to say that the affidavit does not have the status of a statute of limitations.
Your Honor, I understand the argument, what you're saying. I would respond by saying that if you look at 6853A2, it says the court may, upon timely motion of the plaintiff and for good cause shown, grant a single day extension. And then goes on in subsection 3 to say a motion to extend the time for filing an affidavit of merit is timely only if it is filed on or before the filing date that the plaintiff seeks to assert.
Well, that goes back to my earlier question. It's all or nothing. However, another possible construction is, if you allege in good faith an affidavit is not needed, then you wouldn't be asking for a 60-day extension anyway. This seems to suggest you realize an affidavit's needed, the statute is running, and you can't get it, so you're going to file the complaint and say, give me an extra 60 days.
Well, Your Honor, if I can respond to the good faith part of this, medical malpractice is a particular area of the law. There are and what has happened in this situation is that the word foreign object, I mean, this goes back to what a foreign object is. Foreign object is a term of art in medical malpractice. If you look at the case law in Delaware that was on the record, and if you look at the case law from other jurisdictions, it's a term of art. It means those things left in the patient by the doctor, scalpels and sponges, towels, gloves, whatever it may have been. It does not include things that were there prior to the doctor becoming involved in the surgery. That was clear. That is part of those cases that I cited, the Sastry case and the Lacey versus Searle, are in the annotation to that section. A reading of those cases would give an attorney notice that this is not a...
So your point is that there can't be a good faith argument or even allegation that an affidavit of merit was not required.
I think if there had been that is correct, Your Honor. I think if there had been, I think that an attorney has an obligation to make, in whatever field he's practicing, he has an obligation to make a determination of whether his pleading is correct or not.
Well, you're saying that, in essence, as I understand it, that whatever the neglect was here, it's not excusable. Is that right?
Well, I don't think the excusable neglect doctrine applies, but I don't. If we're talking simply about good faith, Your Honor, I don't think there's a good. I don't think it amounts to good faith. Otherwise, you could just simply allege something without checking it out and avoid the affidavit part of the statute. If you're running out of time, for example, and you decide to take a case late, and you say, well, okay, I'm going to allege one of these three narrow exceptions, and I'm going to say tell the prosecutor to take this, and
did the Superior Court address the issue of excusable neglect or just simply conclude there is no power to grant an extension, case dismissed?
I think the Superior Court based it on the statute itself and its construction of the statute being specific to medical malpractice and requiring a strict compliance with the terms of the statute. And yes, there is the motion to extend, but it has to be done before the expiration of the statute.
So the Superior Court basically decided it's all or nothing. If you allege you don't need an affidavit and you're wrong and the statute expires, you lose.
Yes, I think there are only three exceptions from an affidavit: the foreign object, the wrong part of the body, and the fire that breaks out in someplace in the hospital. Those three narrow exceptions create a rebuttable presumption.
But the case was commenced before the statute ran. The only document that wasn't filed was an affidavit of merit.
That is true.
So implicit in the Superior Court's ruling is that, at least in a medical malpractice case, commencement of an action for limitations purposes includes the filing of an affidavit of merit where required.
Yes, Your Honor.
And not just a complaint.
That is correct, and I think the statute equates the filing of the affidavit with the filing of a lawsuit, except in those cases. And if you're going to do it and not file the affidavit, you need to be right about it.
Well, that would almost make any practitioner file an affidavit, even if they think one is not needed, because if the time to dispose of a motion to dismiss is going to take you beyond the statute, you will have lost everything.
Well,
so that means an affidavit is required in every case.
I can tell you, as someone who does this kind of work, that I have several cases in my office at any given time where there is no affidavit filed and it is a foreign object, and the attorneys know that it was a scalpel or a glove or a sponge, and they don't file the affidavit, and they feel confident that they don't need one. Same with wrong part of body or the fire. So, it's there to be known. It's not something that is, there's no surprise to this. And I think to take Judge Silverman's route and say, I'm going to give you time to file your affidavit, or in another case, I'm going to give you, your affidavit doesn't really comply, but I'm going to give you time, is taking away from the narrow terms of the statute that the physicians...
That violates
the statutory scheme, and...
Was there a limitations problem in the McDonald case and Judge Silverman's case?
You know, in that case, the McBride case, Your Honor, I don't know. I tried to... I read through the case again this morning looking for that particular thing. It's not mentioned. I would presume that there was a limitations problem and that he extended
beyond... There was or there wasn't?
There was.
Why would you presume that?
Because otherwise I would think that the attorney would simply refile another lawsuit if he had plenty of time and with the affidavit.
Or perhaps Judge Silverman wanted to skip that step and just let the affidavit be filed as opposed to dismissing it and everyone starting all over.
Well, perhaps. And Your Honor, I agree that there's some common sense approach to Judge Silverman, but I don't think it's the correct one based upon the statute.
Is this a matter of the power of the Superior Court to grant additional time where Judge Silverman is saying, yes, the court has that power without citing any rule, but perhaps thinking of Rule 6, and Judge Cooch saying the Superior Court does not have that power because the statute doesn't grant it?
I think Judge Silverman said in that opinion that he was going to do it because it's a relatively new statute and we're feeling our way along, so I'm going to give the plaintiff 21 days. I'm pretty sure that's what he indicated there.
There was some question whether the statute applied at all, the medical malpractice statute, and when it was determined that it did, then he said your complaint needs an affidavit.
That's right. It was a nursing home case, and... there was a question about whether that provider fell under the terms of the statute.
Your time is up, Mr. Fair.
All right,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Ellison.
Good morning, may it please the court. Mr. Ramuno talked about what he believed the reason for the amendment was, where the personatory doesn't accept it. I'd like to shed some light on that. When a doctor is sued and the personatory accepts it, even if the case is dismissed the next day, the doctor has to declare that in any malpractice insurance application. By doing it this way, he doesn't even have to declare the suit being filed, and that was the main reason for the, that was the reason for it. And I can state that with some degree of certainty, and I apologize not putting in the brief, because I was the guy who suggested in the medical center of Delaware that they amend the statute. I didn't write it. I don't know if the legislature knew that, but I made the suggestion in the Medical Society about a month later put it in. I don't know if that has any bearing on the court's decision, but since I have that information, I'm sharing it with the court. The other point I would point out, as an officer of the court, Mr. Ramuno's statement that BB did not consider this motion when originally filed is correct. I expect the court would probably want to know why I didn't do it initially, and the concept that Judge Cooch came up with of what defines a foreign object, whether it's something the doctor left or a person came into it, that distinction did not occur to me. I'm just being very candid with the court.
Well, the court appreciates that. As Mr. Ramuno said, you're experienced and well-respected in this field, and his point is, if it didn't leap out at you, it didn't leap out at him, and so he filed his complaint in good faith.
And it didn't leap out at me. It turns out, I think, Mr. Ferry thought of something that I didn't think of, and I immediately filed a quote-unquote Me Too motion, and I thought the court should know that as a matter of candor as to what the thought process was back then.
Well, respond in that context. If someone alleges in good faith they don't need an affidavit, why shouldn't they get to litigate that, and if they're wrong, then file the affidavit? Why should the affidavit be elevated to the status of filing the complaint for statute of limitation purposes?
The argument that I would make in support of that as an advocate is that this is the medical malpractice statute, the creature under itself, and this is what the statute says, and harsh as it is, this is what you do.
I understand that, but if we, and the court appreciates your candor as an officer of the court, but looking at the way the statute works, the rules work, and the scheme works, where we have a statute of limitations and a statute that says if you allege you don't need an affidavit, you don't have to file one, and you litigate that, it seems that the Superior Court rules that permit enlargements of time and the statute that says if there's an inconsistency between the statute and the rules controls, we leave some latitude for treating affidavits differently. Do you agree?
Yes. I can't think of a reason not to off the top of my head. I may think of one on the way back to Wilmington, but right now I can't think of one.
Maybe you should ride with Mr. Ferry.
There's also the Superior Court rule that provides that the commencement of an action occurs when the complaint is filed. There's no mention of affidavit of merit or any other expensive document.
And that's true. And with all due respect to the General Assembly, I have a suspicion, and I wasn't there at the time, that when this statute was passed as part of the tort reform compromise, both Mr. Moodle and Mr. Ferry had mentioned, unintended consequences doctrine and how that would, what that would mean was probably never in anybody's thought. Which is probably not unusual for certain statutes to occur. And I wasn't there when it was passed the first time, and wasn't part of the legislative team that drafted it. I do know the net effect, by the way, of the new statute of the affidavit of merit is that a competent plaintiff's attorney will have no difficulty getting around it, but it does prevent the totally frivolous pro se cases from going forward, of which there were quite a few, and doctors were dealing with them, sometimes taking years to be dismissed because of the court's procedures, et cetera, et cetera. That was the net effect. The other thing I wanted to mention, the 37 seconds I have left, is that I think that Judge Cooch's decision where permitting Beebe to join Dr. Tattanini was absolutely correct, and Mr. Ramuno has not challenged that in either his briefing or his oral argument. So what the defense, excuse me, the two defendants will rise and fall together.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just briefly, Your Honor, insofar as the this exception for foreign object is concerned, the only case that I said that says that is Lacey, and Sostry does not really deal with that because that was a catheter, so that would be applicable. But candidly, again, I mean, this statute was passed in July of 2003, so I frankly didn't expect to find any statute. And looking at the annotations would not have helped unless Lacey was read, because the annotation does not deal with that particular issue. So if you read Lacey, of course, you understand. But that was my belief, just like Ms. Effenfond said. I read the thing several times and said, well, it's a foreign object, but I'll file it in time, I'll see what happens, it's accepted, and so forth and so on, and things all fell the wrong way, unfortunately. That is no different, of course, than what happened with the McBride case. In the McBride case, the attorney did not think that the nursing home was applicable under the health care, and that suit, I think the question was asked, was filed on the very last day. The 832 in my appendix to my opening brief does have the motion to dismiss, and in that motion it is alleged that the action was commenced on June 28, 04 as a result of a negligence on the part of defendants on or about June 28, 02. Was actually filed the very last day, so obviously it could not have been
the last day before the limitations period.
Right. Yes.
So the merits of your argument that there was excusable neglect or under all of the circumstances, assuming there's discretion to grant an extension, has not been addressed by the Superior Court.
It was not. The court simply did not talk about excusable neglect and did cite McBride in the footnote, but they're not discussing it anyway.
Okay, and if the Superior Court has not done that yet, are you suggesting we should do that in the first instance?
Well, we deal with this, the court deals this with de novo. So, I mean, since the issue is de novo, then I think this court can decide, at least decide the issue that excusable neglect would allow it to proceed. I mean, this court, Superior Court, Judge Cruz basically said, no matter what happens, That's it. Now, if this court is going to say, if this court is going to follow Judge Cruz's interpretation of the statute, then it gets down to what is the remedy if no affidavit is filed. Then I think this court needs to decide, or needs to tell the Superior Court, that excusable neglect, if that's the standard or whatever the court seems to be the standard, would allow a late filing of an affidavit of merit, just like it applies to under that Rule 6B or 15C or the statute. I mean, I think this court needs to instruct, or I guess instruct is a word, the lower court as to what they need to look at in order to allow a late filing, if that is what this court decides, because Judge Cooch believes, at least by implication, that there is no excuses, excusable or not excusable. Just you don't file an affidavit, you're out. So I think this court needs to at least, maybe not decide whether excusable neglect, but at least indicate that excusable neglect would allow delayed filing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. It goes without saying that the court does its best to decide all of its cases correctly. We look to the lawyers to help us marshal our resources to do that, and the court sincerely appreciates the help of all three of you in bringing the authorities to our attention, your briefing, and your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement and take a short recess.
Please rise.